Yeah, okay, so thank you, Sebastian, for the introduction, and indeed to the organizers for the invitation to come here. I think it's been a wonderful workshop, and so it's a pleasure to end the conference by telling you about some recent experiments that we did in the group of Selim Jochem at the University of Heidelberg. So, so the system that I want to talk about today are two component Fermi gases in two dimensions. And microscopically, at least, the system is very simple, or at least it's very simple to write down the essential ingredients that we need for the systems that I'm interested in today. So we want a two-component Fermi gas. This could just be two different fermionic species or two atoms in two different hyperfine states, which we label with a pseudospin up and down, as shown in this cartoon here. And then we want these particles to interact via some S-wave contact interaction. And so because we have fermionic statistics, we can never have two particles of the same spin state in the same location. So what this means is we have S-wave contact interactions is that the interactions only occur between the different species, but not within one species. Now, the properties of such a system can depend quite strongly on the dimensionality. And so in particular, what I'm interested in today are two-dimensional systems, so where our two-component system here is also confined to live in a single plane. Now, the ingredients are quite easy, quite straightforward, but this system actually displays very rich physics. So these two-component S-wave Fermi gases actually realize high-temperature superconductivity. In fact, they show the highest critical temperature for superconductivity known in any system. By tuning the S-wave interaction strength, we can actually realize different types of superfluids. So we can look at BC, BCS-type superfluids, BKT transition, FFL all states, and so on. So these simple ingredients here give rise to very rich physics. And what's particularly exciting to me is that we actually have a very good implementation, a direct physical implementation of this model system that I'm interested in. So we can take an ultra-cold gas of neutral particles, use laser cooling to cool it down to extremely low temperatures to realize exactly this two-dimensional Fermi gas without any impurities, without disorder. So it's a very clean implementation. These cold gases naturally interact via S-wave contact interactions. So we already have this interaction ingredient naturally present in our system. And on top of that, we actually have Feshbach resonance to tune the strength of the interactions over a very large range. So we have highly tunable interactions. And as you already saw in some other talks this week, or also heard in the talk this morning, we can use optical potentials to confine the geometry, to define the trapping geometry that these particles experience. So for example, we can use optical lattices to realize one-dimensional tubes or two-dimensional pancake-shaped systems and really dial in the geometry that we're interested in. So using these ultra-cold Fermi gases, we have really a highly tunable and high-fidelity implementation of this 2D quantum system that we're interested in. And moreover, we have very good control of this system and very nice observables. So all the physics happens at length and timescales that are very easily accessible in experiments. So we can actually look at these quantum systems in a spatially and temporally resolved way. So for example, we can directly resolve dynamics in a many-body quantum system. And so one interesting scenario that I'm interested in today is a scale invariant scenario. So this is the situation where you have a physical system that has no intrinsic length scale. Then you have no absolute scale that dictates the physics, and basically the phenomenology of such a system does not depend on its absolute scale. A very well-known example is from statistical physics is actually what happens at a critical point. So that it's a very finely tuned point, but near that point you get fluctuations on all length scales. So a system at a critical point will actually look self-similar on all possible length scales, and the behavior does not depend on any intrinsic scale of the system. In cold gases, such a scale invariant point can be realized in the unitary Fermi gas. This is quite a famous example, where we can actually tune the scattering length that defines the interaction between the particles to infinity. So then the scattering no longer provides a a relevant scale, and the only scale that is left in the problem is actually the spacing between the particles. So this means that I get universal behavior, namely that all the properties of this unitary Fermi gas are just directly related to the Fermi energy or the density of the system. So this is quite nice. I can directly realize this unitary Fermi gas in a lab. So what this means is that I can just prepare this ultra-cold cloud here, tune the interaction strength to this unitary point, and then I get universal physics, where actually the behavior of my ultra-cold cloud that happens on a micron scale should be somewhat similar to what happens, for example, in a neutron star, where the interparticle spacing is only femtometers. So the absolute scale changes over many orders of magnitude, but because I have the scale invariant scenario, the qualitative physics should be similar. So this kind of a interesting statement. Sounds quite cool to have this correspondence here, and people have been talking about this for a few years, but it's probably a good thing that no one can really check, right? I mean, no one can really tell me how this neutron star here actually behaves compared to cold atoms.
But is it expected that neutrons interact as fermions at unitarity without any length scale?
So I think this argument is based on the fact that the scattering cross section here is, I think, much larger than the interparticle spacing. So that's sort of the basic argument. Okay, but so far no one can really call you out on this. It's hard to check. And so this changed, of course, about a year ago. So and as you know, LIGO did for the first time detected a neutron star merger. So now it's actually possible to really look at dynamics of neutron stars. And so we have a completely new window to look at what happens in neutron stars. So this is this merger here that is shown, I think, in the gravitational field and in the matter wave field here. okay, and so now we have a very interesting situation where we no longer think about neutron stars sitting there in isolations, but we actually have a very highly dynamic system where dynamics are happening on very fast scales. And so maybe an interesting thing to think about is actually, how seriously can I take this connection? Can I really learn something about this neutron star merger from looking at a cold Fermi gas? Yeah, so if I want to understand the dynamics here, I need to learn something about the excitation spectrum, the collective modes, maybe the hydrodynamics that are going on in this system. Maybe this is now actually an interesting connection to think about what happens on a cosmic scale compared to something that is realized with a few hundred thousand particles on the micron scale in a lab. So if you've gotten to the end of the week and you're feeling a little bit panicked because you haven't really found the right low energy challenge, maybe this is something that would actually be worth thinking about. So this is just kind of a side remark. I do actually want to talk about the scenario where the scale invariance can emerge in a cold Fermi gas in a well-controlled scenario in the lab. Okay, and so the very simple example is just that of a single particle in free space. Then we have the kinetic Hamiltonian that we can write down. And of course, you know that the solutions to this Hamiltonian are just plane waves e to the ikx here. And so if I want to know whether this system is scale invariant, we can apply a coordinate transformation. So we rescale a spatial coordinate by some constant factor lambda here. And what you, of course, find is that on the one hand, the global Hamiltonian is just scaled by a constant factor 1 over lambda squared here. And the eigenstates remain the same. Right? So these plane waves will be self-similar under this transformation when momentum is rescaled. So, of course, the single particle in free space has no intrinsic length scale, and we find that the eigenstates and the Hamiltonian transform very trivially under this coordinate transformation. So this is the free particle case. Now, of course, this becomes more interesting when we add interactions to this picture. So we're now talking about a system of several particles, and we have the kinetic energy for each particle here and some interaction that depends on the distance between the particles, the pairwise distance between the particles. So the first candidate for a scale invariant interaction potential could be a power law, so where the potential between the particles just depends on their relative distance and some inverse power. And you can see that if you apply this coordinate transformation here, you simply pick up this factor 1 over lambda to the alpha outside your potential. And so this tells you how the potential actually scales under this coordinate rescaling. So looking at the total Hamiltonian, you have your kinetic piece, which you know scales as 1 over lambda squared. And you have the interaction piece, which gets this factor 1 over lambda to the alpha. So if you want this full system to be scale invariant, you need to pick alpha to be equal to 2, which means that this power law, the only power law potential here that gives a scale invariant behavior is the inverse square potential. So this looks like this. But this is actually, it's not often realized in nature. So it's kind of it's a very special case. And it's not many physical implementations. Now, another candidate is for the interaction potential is the contact potential. So say we have contact interactions in d dimensions here, so which I can just specify this by some delta function here. Then you can recall this property of the delta function that under coordinate transformation, it picks up a factor of 1 over lambda outside the delta function. So this means that in d dimensions, this contact, the contact interactions scale like this. So you pick up a factor of 1 over lambda to the d outside your interaction term. Again, looking at the full Hamiltonian, we get the kinetic part and the interaction part. And so you see actually that something nice happens here, that if I'm in two dimensions, I always get scale invariant behavior under this assumption of contact interactions. So this doesn't matter on the strength, or it doesn't depend on the strength of the interaction. So there's no fine tuning required. The only ingredient is that I have these contact interactions, and then I would expect scale invariant behavior or in two dimensions. Now, this is of course nice for us because we don't need to tune these interactions, and we naturally have these contact interactions present in cold gases. So we can realize the scale invariant scenario pretty easily in our experiments. However, what typically happens is that we don't have a uniform piece of this 2D Fermi system. We actually have these particles in a trap. So we typically have a harmonic potential that confines the particles in our experiments. So this adds this quadratic term to the Hamiltonian here. And you immediately see that this scales very differently under this coordinate transformation. There's no way to reconcile these two pieces of the Hamiltonian. So whenever we have a system that is trapped in a harmonic potential, we actually do break the scale invariance that would be there in a uniform system. So this looks like bad news for the scale invariant scenario, but it turns out that there is actually a hidden symmetry. So this was pointed out by Peterewski and Roche, who showed that this system described by contact interactions trapped in a harmonic potential actually has a dynamical SO2 scaling symmetry. So this involves the two spatial and one time dimension. And what this tells you actually is that in such a many-body system, the spectrum takes on a very peculiar form. In particular, if you have some eigenstate of the many-body system here, then you know just from the symmetry that the spectrum actually contains this infinite tower of states, where all the many-body eigenstates are spaced by 2 h bar omega. And so I almost get a harmonic oscillator-like spectrum for the many-body system, where the spacing here is just set by the trap frequency of the harmonic trap.
Does it depend on how many particles you have? Meaning it's only the infinite number of particles?
I don't think so, no. It's just a symmetry property of this Hamiltonian, basically. And so again, it doesn't depend on the interaction strength either. So you know, this could be some very complicated many-body state, but still I find this property of the excitation spectrum. Now, so this is of course a very interesting situation that for a many-body system we have such a a simple prediction for the spectrum. And of course, it has important implications for the dynamics. So if I have any dynamics happening in such a harmonic oscillator type spectrum, I get very strong constraints on the dynamics. Again, the simplest example for this is just a single non-interacting particle sitting in a harmonic trap, right? So let's just say we have a single particle here in a harmonic oscillator trap. Then you, of course, know that the energy spectrum here is harmonic, with spaced by h bar omega. And additionally, if you now induce dynamics in the system, so if you want to look at what this energy spectrum does to your dynamics, one thing you can do is to modulate the trap frequency, like shown here. So this is this excitation or this drive is symmetric in space. So what this will actually do, it will couple your ground state to all the even eigenstates. So you can expand your wave function in these even eigenstates. And of course, you see in this single particle picture that the dynamics must be periodic with a frequency of 2 omega. So because you're only using every other eigenstate. Now this you know from single particle quantum mechanics. There's nothing special here. But what this scaling symmetry or this dynamical scaling symmetry actually tells you is that also the shape of the wave function remains invariant under these dynamics. So whenever I initiate dynamics with this kind of drive, I can relate the density or the square of the wave function at some time t to the initial density just by some scaling transformation. So you have to rescale your spatial coordinates and you pick up this factor out front here, and then this evolution of this system will always be self-similar. It will always be given, or will always depend only on the initial density distribution and on the time evolution of this single scaling parameter here. Now it's pretty simple to work out what the scaling parameter is. In this case, it's just a simple sinusoid. Yeah? So you can also use the scaling symmetry to basically tell you that under such a drive, this single particle wave packet will just be a Gaussian thing fluctuating in its width in the trap. So this is just a single particle case. But of course, the interesting thing is that this also holds for the many-body case. So I can, again, go to the many-body case, where now I have some n-body system where this vector x here denotes actually the position of all particles in my system here. And so what Werner and Castin actually pointed out is that in such a scenario, when I use a drive in the trap frequency to excite dynamics, I know actually the exact many-body wave function at all times. Namely, it's given by the initial wave function here and some simple scaling transformation plus this additional phase factor here. So it's quite a remarkable statement, actually, that I know in a many-body system, I can make a statement about the exact wave function at any time during some evolution. And all I need to know for this is I need to solve the differential equation governing this scale parameter. So this has very profound consequences for the dynamics. So in particular, it's specified only by this one scale parameter here. And because I have this structure in the excitation spectrum, I also know that only modes spaced by 2 h bar omega can be involved. So this automatically means that all the dynamics need to be exactly periodic with a frequency or a frequency two times the trap frequency, and there cannot be any damping or thermalization.
You have such a tower state for each many-body eigenstate, right?
Mm-hmm.
For each primary. Right?
Yeah.
But the spectrum of primaries can be incommensurate.
Yes, so you can have many manifolds of these that could be interleaved.
That means that this mode still has period on it.
Yeah. And under this particular drive, that you're only modulating the trap frequency, you're basically only using one of these powers of modes. And so under this drive, you get dynamics that are exactly periodic with 2 omega and that cannot thermalize.
Sorry, lambda of t, so you're saying if whatever I do in the system is equivalent to a time-dependent scale transformation, I have a certain lambda of t. Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
So in the real system, I also need to modulate the strength of the contact interactions and of the and also the mass of the kinetic term. No? Why the modulating the trap frequency is enough?
Yeah, I mean, you have some particular eigenstate that you start with, let's say. And then, okay, so in this case, you're just thinking about, okay, what drive can I apply that also preserves the symmetry of this scaling transformation, right? So it can't work for any drive, for any arbitrary drive. Yeah? So it's this particular drive protocol. We just modulate the strength of the harmonic trap, and this will give rise to dynamics that show these features and that are basically determined by this by only a single differential equation for classical scale parameter.
But it's important that the initial state, as for example, as well-defined particle number. I mean, if you take a linear combination of these states, then this phase will actually start to matter, right?
Yes, so this can happen. Yeah.
So you start with one of these ground states.
Mm-hmm. That's the assumption for now. Yeah. Okay, so this is what we get out of this dynamical scaling symmetry. But of course, we've neglected one thing so far, right? We've assumed that this is just a classical potential. So we just wrote down the potential as a single bare delta function, and we've assumed that this is a fine potential to use in a quantum mechanical problem. However, it actually turns out that this is not the case. So, for example, if you take an attractive delta potential and look at the scattering in two dimensions, what you find is that this bare delta potential actually gives you bound states with infinite negative energy. So it can't be a good physical description of the problem at hand. So what needs to happen is that you need to regularize this delta function potential. So you need to either give it some momentum cutoff or give it some finite range. Yeah, so you have to regularize the delta potential. Now we can't go through this or don't want to go through this in detail, but we can actually kind of find out what has to happen from a simple toy model. So we can just look at the attractive square well. So you can look at this in 3D and just ask, well, under what circumstances do you get a bound state in this attractive square well? And what you find that in three dimension, there's actually a critical attraction strength below which this potential does not support a bound state. So this is shown here. This is a weakly attractive here, which corresponds to the case where your scattering length is negative. Here you have no bound state inside the potential. There might be some virtual state up here in the continuum, but you don't have a real bound state in the system. And as you increase the strength of the attractive interaction here, you can kind of pull in this one state from the continuum here. You can go to this threshold case where your scattering length diverges, and only beyond this critical interaction strength do you actually get a well-defined bound state in 3D in the square well. Now in 2D, this is very different. So you can go through the problem, and what you find is that actually in 2D, this square well supports a bound state for any attractive interaction strength. So I will always have at least one bound state in here. And as I increase the strength of the interaction, the binding energy grows and the size of this bound state shrinks, but there's no critical interaction strength. Like this bound state is always there. And now, of course, what this means is that I always have this new energy scale in the system here, this binding energy, so I can also use this to define some new length scale here, which is this A2D, which is a new length scale that is always present in this regularized problem. So we didn't have this in the classical problem, but when I treat the kind of scattering problem quantum mechanically, when I regularize problem properly in two dimensions, I always find this bound state and this new length scale here. And so this is bad news for our scaling symmetry, because now I have a new length scale. So this A to D actually breaks the scale invariance in 2D and this dynamical scaling symmetry. Now, this is sort of an interesting case in itself. So this is known as a quantum anomaly. So I have a classical Hamiltonian that has an exact symmetry on the classical level. But when I start to quantize this theory, you get divergences appearing in the problem that you need to regularize. And in this regularization procedure, a new scale emerges that actually breaks the symmetry of the original problem. So to speak, quantum fluctuations break the symmetry of the original classical problem. And this shows up in various fields as the so-called quantum anomaly. And in our case, it's the 2D scattering length that gives this new scale.
Did something similar happen with the repulsive delta functions?
Does it really
have to do with the existence of bound states, or?
It's a dimensional transmutation.
Yes.
Or it's with the bounds. I think that's with the bounds.
I think so too. Yeah.
And perhaps one case is marginally relevant, the other case is marginally relevant.
But you can kind of think of the flashback resonance in a 2D case being at zero interaction. To zero rather than to a finite value,
mm-hmm.
the scattering like to diverge.
Yeah, I think we'll come to this. Yeah, okay, so we look at the scattering problem, we get this new length scale, and we can also actually look at we also have to look at the scattering process itself, look at by looking at the scattering amplitude. So scattering amplitude for the two-particle problem, which actually determines all the scattering properties in the system. So scattering cross-sections, the phase shifts encountered in collisions, and so on, can be read off from this low-energy approximation to the scattering amplitude. And what you find here is that this has this interesting dependence on the log of a momentum times this 2D scattering length. So it has this unusual logarithmic dependence here, which will actually also enter all the phase shifts and the cross-sections and so on. So in 2D, you get this interesting situation that all these properties, all the scattering properties, kind of logarithmically depend on this combination KA2D here. So you get this running coupling of the logarithmic parameters. And in particular, you have a new, you find out that the proper interaction parameter for this 2D problem is this combination here. So for many-body systems, this would be the log of the Fermi momentum in the 2D scattering length. So this is what sets the scattering problems in a 2D system. Now with this, we can finally draw the phase diagram for such a 2D Fermi gas, which is shown here. So this is temperature in units of the Fermi temperatures here on the vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis, we have the scattering parameter log of K of A2D. So in general, you see a transition from a normal state to a superfluid state here, which changes its character according to this interaction parameter log K of A to D. So this is kind of a pretty strange quantity, but you should realize that really what it does, it just compares the kinetic energies given by the Fermi wave vector to the strength of this bound state. So it just compares the binding energy to the Fermi energy. In other words, I can write out the bound state, the binding energy compared to the Fermi energy just as exponential of this interaction parameter log K of A to D. And so what's really happening here in the system that going along this axis, we're just tuning the energy of the binding energy of the bound state. And we can really tune this over a huge range in our system using a Feshbach resonance. So if I'm on the so-called BEC side here, this bound state is about 400 times larger, or 400 times the Fermi energy. So it's by far the largest energy scale in the system. And if I go to the so-called BCS side, it becomes exponentially small. So it's some tiny correction to the Fermi energy. Now, what this means is that basically in both limits of this phase diagram, I can have fairly simple physics. So here I have this huge binding energy. So that just means that two particles always come together, form a dimer, basically form a bosonic molecule that is very tightly bound. So on this end here, I have basically bosonic physics where I can have non-condensed bosonic dimers at high temperatures that form basically a bosonic molecular Bose-Einstein condensate at low temperatures here. Over here, I'm in the other regime. We have extremely, where this binding energy is extremely small, so it doesn't impact the physics much. It's a tiny correction here. So here, basically, have almost ideal weakly attractive fermions. So here, I expect to form a BCS-type superfluid. And it's only in this middle here where this log K of A to D is roughly equal to 1 or 0. This is the strongly interacting region where actually the bound state and the Fermi energy are roughly on the same scale, and where we would expect this bound state to have a big impact on our system. And this is, in fact, the strongly correlated region where the mean field approaches from both sides here fail. Now what I want to actually show today is that we want to probe the effect of this quantum anomaly. So we want to see how this bound state here affects dynamics in a many-body Fermi system. And our expectation is that it will exactly in this strongly correlated region, it will have the biggest effect where it's neither extremely small nor extremely large. Okay, so this is just what I said in pictures. So here you form these dimers, and you essentially get bosonic physics of dimers. Here you get kind of Cooper pairing with very large pairs. Okay, so going back to this scaling symmetry, what it originally predicted is that if this scaling symmetry holds, then if I look, for example, at the breathing mode, I have the exact result that it has to happen at twice the trap frequency and that it has to be completely undamped. So this is what the prediction that I get from my dynamical scaling symmetry. If I now have this quantum anomaly, so I properly take the 2D scattering length into account, this will actually produce a shift on this breathing mode. So this was first pointed out by Maxime Olchany and then by others. A simple way to check for the effect of the quantum anomaly is actually just to look at the frequency of a many-body breathing mode. There have been some theoretical studies on this. For example, Johannes Hoffmann used some quantum Monte Carlo data to actually work out what this breathing mode should be from an equation of state generated from quantum Monte Carlo data. And so what you actually see that versus this interaction parameter here, you expect actually pretty strong deviations in the breathing mode frequency from 2. So 2 here would be the scale invariant result. And here these predictions go up to actually 2.15, 2.2. So they're actually strong corrections.
The stability of the breathing mode, even in the case where there's really conformed symmetry, depends on the roundness of the trap?
Yeah. And if you have a non-interacting system, then it can actually, your trap is not quite round, then it can split into different modes. And interactions will couple those. And so typically when the assumption is that your interactions are strong enough to give hydrodynamics, in which case this will actually lock into a single frequency. This is also something that is actually beyond this symmetry though, right? So then you've explicitly broken the symmetry and this can then also give violations of this undamped condition.
Right, so if you're gonna worry about corrections from this anomaly, I guess
Yeah, of course, you have to worry about many things. Yeah. Okay, so this then finally allows us to do some experiments just looking precisely at this frequency of the breathing mode in 2D. So this is a view of one of the experiments that we have in Heidelberg. This is the main vacuum chamber here. So it's a single chamber experiment. This is where everything happens. Over here is an oven that actually produces lithium in our case. And we have a Zeeman slower here to do the initial cooling. But then all our cooling and trapping and manipulation and so on takes place in this vacuum chamber where we have just a lot of optics around here to generate all the trapping potentials and so forth. So as I said, we're using lithium-6, which is quite a nice element to work with because there's a nice Feshbach resonance. We can use the standard cooling techniques to make a magneto-optical trap and then to further cool the sample by forced evaporation in these optical dipole traps. So this just shows you that we can here confine our atoms, for example, in this cross-dipole trap that is just formed by two laser beams intersecting here. To go to the 2D regime, we use a single optical lattice. So we just make a single periodic structure in one dimension here. And then we load our atomic cloud of about 100,000 particles into a single pancake here of this 2D optical lattice. And to probe the system, we simply take an absorption imaging from the top. So we just get a picture of the density profile of this cloud in situ. Now this experiment on the breathing mode is actually rather simple. We just take our system, we slowly compress the trap, and then non-adiabatically release it. So we just basically give this system some excitation in the radial direction, and then we can just track the dynamics here. So you just see that this thing is breathing very nicely. It looks pretty round at this point. We can just track this evolution here. So the scale is about 100 microns across, and one oscillation is about 20 milliseconds. And so we can now track this over over time. And what we see actually is we see many undamped or almost undamped oscillations here. So we can see 100 to 200 oscillations. So this breathing mode seems to be very close to undamped. Of course, we can also easily read off the frequency here. So we can just very precisely measure the frequency of the breathing mode. Then the question is it actually twice the trap frequency? And so this is actually a little hard to answer because you need a good way of measuring the trap frequency, which you don't necessarily get from this experiment. So we need to still verify whether we have the scale invariant result here or not. And so a simple way to check is to also look at the dipole mode. So for this experiment, you just take your cloud, displace it slightly in the trap, and then when you let it go, it also sloshes back and forth there. So you see this travels around. And simply by reading off the frequency of the oscillations of the center of mass here, we can get the trap frequency for this 2D system. And then we basically have our clock also with in the same experiment. And we simply need to compare this frequency that we get for the breathing mode to the frequency that we get for the dipole mode here. So this is what we see looking at different interaction strengths here. We're comparing the measured breathing mode frequency to the trapping frequency. You see that in both limits, in the BCS limit and the BEC limit, we're close to this scale invariant prediction here of 2. But near the center, we see this very clear deviation from 2. So this is really saying that here, where the binding energy in the system is close to the Fermi energy, you're seeing a strong correction to this scale invariant prediction via the quantum anomaly. So this upshift here is this anomalous frequency shift on the breathing mode. Of course, many systematics go into this, looking at trap anisotropies, trap anharmonicities, and so on. But this is all included here. And we're pretty sure that this is a significant effect just based on the interaction or just stemming from the interactions in the system.
So could you explain how you know the frequency of the dipole mode?
Yeah. So we're looking, this is the center of mass displacement of the dipole mode. And okay, this is just reading off the frequency from this oscillation.
Is there an extra that's equal to the trap frequency? The trap frequency? That's some simple thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's Kohn's theorem that tells you that the dipole mode, regardless of what the interactions are, always occurs at the trap.
So what is this black curve that you are comparing to?
Yes, so this is actually this theory curve that I showed you earlier, which, as I mentioned, shows actually much larger corrections. Yeah? So the zero temperature prediction is that as this ratio should go up to 2.2 or so. And what we're seeing in the experiment is qualitatively the same. Like, it's similar here, but the correction is actually much smaller than what this prediction is. Of course, a number of effects. So we're not at zero temperature. We're at this P over TF of 0.14 here. So this can play a role. Also, we don't have an actual 2D system. So this was a calculation performed for an actual 2D system, but our system is a 3D system embedded or a 2D system embedded in 3D. So we only have a quasi two-dimensional system, and we have to think about how well this motion out of the plane is actually frozen out. And so we can check this by just varying the particle number in our system. So what's plotted here is, again, this frequency ratio for different particle numbers. And this is normalized to N2D here, which is just the maximum number of fermions that we can put into basically one harmonic oscillator level in the transverse direction. Yeah. So when we keep filling in fermions, what will happen here is that these particles out here no longer populate the ground state in the transverse direction, but they actually go to higher levels. And so you can see here that there's some saturation here, but pretty quickly as you increase the particle number and you go to this to the point where this ratio is 1, this drops down to significantly lower frequencies. And actually this square root 10 over 3 is what you would expect for bosons in 3D. So this kind of makes sense that this frequency goes down as you go from the 2D towards the 3D limit. Yeah. So at the moment, so we have measured this It's anomalous shift of the frequency, of the breathing mode frequency. And there are a few systematics here that we need to figure out. So finite temperature, the presence of the third dimension. Doing this theoretically is actually quite involved. And so there have been a number of works recently actually addressing this and the impact of these of finite temperature and the third dimension on this breathing mode. Yeah.
So, if I understand you correctly, the difference from this higher theory curve is mainly temperature, right?
Yeah, so, well, temperature and, okay, so here it looks like this has somewhat saturated, but, okay, there's not so much data here, right, so it's hard to say. I mean, it could still be that basically the third direction still plays a role.
And because the error bars on the temperature are rather high, right? So is that actually a fitting error or is it a statistical error?
On the temperature?
Yes.
This is a fitting error, so it becomes actually quite hard to properly determine temperature there.
Sorry, I'm confused about the theoretical prediction, the curve you were showing. So you're saying in both directions you should go to 2.
Yeah.
Can you say again why?
So this side is the BC limit. So on this side, you basically have, the fermions always bind into molecules. And as you go out here towards this limit, you basically get weakly interacting bosonic molecules.
Okay. So it becomes a free theory of bosons, essentially.
Yeah, weakly interacting bosons, so Rosputevsky type physics. And so this actually, you can do this perturbatively, and this gives you some curve that like diverges coming from this end. Similar from this side, you basically start with free fermions or weakly interacting fermions. This also gives you some perturbative predictions. They both diverge from both directions. And then this thing is kind of the quantum Monte Carlo that just numerically connects the two regimes. Okay, and I should say that recently Chris Vale's group from Swinburne also performed very similar experiments, and they qualitatively find similar behavior. So their frequency shift is a little bigger, but they also find this discrepancy from the theory data here. And we're currently trying to figure out how this goes together.
The gray data point, what does it denote?
So here we're going very far to the BC side, which actually means that we already have some three body losses going on in the experiment. So the temperatures are higher. We don't see as many oscillations. So this is kind of, it's not really included in this data set, right? It's just to check that, okay, I don't know, nothing dramatic happens out.
Sorry, again, the curve is in the t equals 0 limit, right?
Yeah.
So it should be superfluid throughout.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the frequency of the breathing mode for which we had a clear prediction from the dynamical scaling symmetry. But it actually goes further than this, right? So I said earlier that in this dynamical scaling scenario, we know exactly how a wave function should evolve under an excitation like the one I just showed you. So we can actually do more than just look at the frequency. We can actually look at the evolution of both the in situ density and the momentum space density, which we measure after some kind of time of flight measurement in the system. And so I just want to look at a single cycle of this breathing mode. So this is now, again, just looking at the cloud oscillating in the harmonic trap here. And this is a half cycle, so starting at the inner turning point where the cloud is smallest, basically expanding, going to the outer turning point, where again here the density evolution has stopped. And the cloud has reached its largest radius. So we can look at what the scale invariant scenario predicts for the real space and the momentum space density here. And in particular, in situ or in real space, this is very simple. So we start with an initial density distribution here. And no matter where I am in this breathing cycle here, I can always find the real space density as just a rescaled version of the t equals 0 density. So the density should always just be given by some rescaled version of the density at the inner turning point. In k-space, this is similar. So let's say we have an initial distribution here. Then at the turning point here, it should also be related to this to the inner turning point by a simple scaling transformation. In between, it does something more complicated, and we also know what it should be, but we can just ignore this for now and just focus on the two turning points. And so look at the inner and the outer turning point, and here both the in situ as well as the momentum space density should just be given by these rescaling relations with inverse scaling factors. So in the experiment, we can do exactly this. So now we're focusing just on these two points during the evolution, the inner and the outer turning point. And we're comparing in situ density profiles and momentum space density profiles. And so what we see in the BC limit looking in situ is that we can measure here the density profile at the outer and at the inner turning point, and we can perfectly well scale them onto each other with a single scaling parameter here. So this works out quite nicely. And in fact, if we look in situ space, or if we're in real space, no matter what the interaction is here, so whether we're in the BC limit, in the crossover, in the BCS side, more or less these density profiles always fall right on top of each other when we apply this scaling transformation. So in real space, this rescaling works very well. On the other hand, we can also look at momentum space. And we can, again, look at the different interaction regimes. Here we see, again, the profiles at the outer and the inner turning point here. And you see in the BC regimes, this scaling transformation works very well. These profiles fall right onto each other. Similar in the BCS limit, we can get the inner profile from rescaling the outer one. But in the strongly interacting region here in the center, you see that this fails completely. So the rescaled version of the outer density profile here completely fails to describe the momentum profile at the inner turning point. So here in momentum space, you really see a strong deviation from this scale invariant prediction. And in fact, if you look at just the sizes involved here, so here you see that in real space, the cloud is largest at the outer turning point. So you would actually expect this to be smallest in momentum space. They're just reciprocal spaces. So when the cloud is large in real space, it should be small in momentum space. But in fact, in momentum space, we actually find that this is inverted. And so even qualitatively, this simple scaling doesn't hold anymore. And so what this tells you is that in this strongly interacting regime, there's actually a very strong modification of the coherence properties of this sample that deviates from what you would expect from the scale invariant scenario. And so the last thing I want to show you on this is that we can also look at coherence profiles. So we can get first order correlation functions simply from looking at the Fourier transform of the momentum space distribution. And we can look at how that scales during this breathing motion. And we have a BKT type superfluid. So what you find in two dimensions generically is that these first order coherence functions behave like some power law. So if we plot log of G1 of R versus on this log plot, we always find this linear behavior. So you get this characteristic power law. In the BEC regime, we can look at the outer and inner turning point, and we can scale them onto each other. So the coherence properties are also just given by this scaling relation. However, if we go to the strongly interacting regime into the crossover, then we actually find that this scaling no longer works. And in fact, the exponents that we extract for these power laws for the correlation functions are different at the inner and outer turning point. So again, showing you that the coherence properties of the sample deviate strongly from the scale invariant expectation. Just combining this information here, we can look at the ratio of these exponents at the inner and outer turning point, and you see this around LNKFA equals 1 here. You see this region where the scaling no longer works and the exponent is different at the inner and the outer turning. So I think with this, I actually want to conclude. So we've been looking at this, at the phase diagram of the two-dimensional Fermi gas, especially in the context of scale invariance here. And so what we find is that in the BC, in the BCS limit, we actually see these scale invariant dynamics. But in the strongly interacting regions, we see deviations from this, both in the breathing mode and actually in the time evolution of the wave function. So we see this violation of the scale invariant in case space. And so we have There are also many other experiments we can do. For example, we've recently looked at RF spectroscopy, actually in the normal phase here in this region, and you find that in this strongly interacting region, the pairing energy, or there are pairs present already above the condensation temperature, and that the wave function or the binding energy of these pairs is actually strongly density dependent. So these pairs are also modified by many-body effects. We're now developing some new techniques to actually look at these states with single particle resolution. So we have developed some new techniques to detect individual particles in momentum space. So what we think we will be able to do soon is to look at these systems, actually looking at these types of correlators where we can resolve, where we can get spin-resolved momentum correlation functions to characterize the coherence properties of small superfluid samples. Well, now I'm at the end. Okay, yeah, so I basically just want to thank the team who did the work. So these 2D experiments were mostly done here by Puneet Murthy, Luca Bayer, and Marvin Holton. And I would also like to acknowledge our theory collaborators, Tilman Enns and Nicolò De Fenu, who provided the theory support for the experiments. And so with this, thank you very much.
More questions?
Has someone measured the free mode of the unitary photogas in three dimensions?
And so this is that was also shown on this plot that I showed you from the in the 2D 3D crossover. So there you should get the square root 3, and yeah, this was observed. I would have to check with myself. It was early days, I think.
What is the figure of merit for the 2D-ness of the scattering really? When we think about like the effect of a certain dimension, so what's, you know, you could just squeeze your potential more and maybe it becomes more 2D in this sense.
This is maybe not. Okay. So the basically the physics arises due to this bound state that you have in 2D, and so you can also get the or in 2D the Feshbach resonance is shifted. So it's not actually the resonance between the free molecule and two particles, but it's actually shifted by this binding by the zero point energy in the potential. So you enter the strongly interacting region when your 3D scattering length is similar to the 2D confinement length scale. For how you determine your 2D-ness, I mean, one way is to compare basically the Fermi energy to H bar omega z. And in all our experiments, this is always a challenging thing to achieve. And so, I also showed you the data versus the particle number. So we're often not so far away from this. So our Fermi energy is often, say, half the harmonic oscillator spacing in the z direction. So that's not so far in the 2D limit, actually.
So obviously,
you could squeeze the chapter number. Yeah, right. We currently don't have the capability. But that's what you would like to do.
Is the crossover from two dimensions to three dimensions understood? I'm surprised that making the thing wider actually has such a great effect. It's naively, a wider thing is still just a bunch of 2D modes, right?
Yeah. So this is not very well understood, right? So, I mean, it's theoretically quite hard, and also experimentally. I mean, it's honestly not so clear to me like what a good experiment would be to really probe the crossover and what to look for. And I mean, so you always have this problem, right? That you're doing a 2D experiment in a 3D world. So it is, I mean, quantitatively in many experiments, this can have an impact.
I remember one experiment actually, Martin Silens, where they looked at at you know RF spectra in you know in paired superfluids in like 1D lattice and you vary the lattice steps, which means like a couple of pancakes in one limit, or you know, and 3D system reading, and then you go into a couple of pancakes, and then you are even you know increasing the lattice steps further, so you decouple the pancakes. And you see actually in the RF spectra you can sort of quantify the difference between the 2Dness and 3Dness. And that reflects the change of the, you know, bump state character in 3D.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So Martin did these experiments. Yeah. Yeah. So then, I mean, then they were probing, yeah, RF binding energies,
yes,
basically. So it's very much like a 2D observable, two particle observable.
Yes.
How this affects many body observables like coherence. This is much harder.
So if I would do the very same experiment with the 2D strongly interacting boson gas, would I just see a flat curve?
No, I think you would get,
yeah,
you'd get the same. So actually, this theoretical prediction that I showed you, that peaks in the middle. So from approaching from the left, this is what you get from a bosonic prediction. So,
oh, yeah.
And in fact, so Hélène Perrin and Massimo Ciani, they've been trying to actually see this quantum anomaly in a 2D boson gas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also there. It's just much weaker. You can't go to this regime where it's,
yeah,
it's actually large. That's like, you know, a part in a thousand.
That's not the case. Let's thank you again.